So I wanted to talk about a little bit before OA. And my introduction to the 12 steps was in about 1987. And I joined Avalon, and I went into adult children of alcoholics. So I was in the room with all these people, like 60 people in a room. We're all hugging teddy bears and panda bears. I had a Curious George, because it was my thing, and I still sleep with my Curious George. I hate to admit that to the crowd, but I do. So I learned about this whole concept of the inner child. And that has really helped me throughout my whole life understand a lot of my compulsive overeating. And people who know me, some people know me in this room, I will bring that up at meetings because I think it has a lot to do with some of my background and the way I came forward into OA. So I was born in Washington, D.C. I was a child of two military parents, both medical people. My father became a high government official. We had to look good. My mother was a certified beauty queen. She was Miss Marilyn. So she was all about looking good. Dad was more like Spencer Tracy. He was a man's man, athletic, but the alcoholic in the family. Mother never went to Al-Anon. He went to one AA meeting, said they're like gutter drunks, and said, I won't go back. He couldn't relate to them. But, you know, I always tell the story about my father driving home from the country club, and Mom had already called up there and said, is Dr. Faber there? No. He left. And it's been like an hour. We live like 2 miles from this place, so it's a long drive. So I said, well, Mom, his car's out in the driveway out there. And she goes, well, I wonder what happened. I said, oh, he fell out of the car, and he's on the driveway. To me, that was no different than a gutter drunk.
Yeah.
You know, but in his mind, he was different. So he could never identify him with Alcoholics Anonymous. He died at an old age of a stroke and a wet brain and all that stuff. So I thought, for me, in this disease, it's really important that I identified in. And I say that to every newcomer I've ever met, please identify in. If you don't identify in with your first meeting, go to another meeting, go somewhere else. Just keep trying to identify in, because eventually you're going to hear someone tell part of your story, and that'll hook you. Or you'll see someone that reminds you of yourself, and that'll hook you. But it's absolutely essential in my mind to identify in. Anyway, so I'm raised in this family. We're looking good. I'm going to pass around my little book. It starts with me in the 1950s. My Dora Explorer years, I call them. And my parents didn't give us teething rings. We have these pictures of all of us chewing on beer pretzels. That was our teething ring. Yeah. My dad was a dentist, so I think he thought that was better than having a teething ring. It was actually something you could sink your teeth into. So I say that as one of my first probably overeating experiences. My second one was with my dog. I got a dog when I was 4 years old. I've always loved dogs. And I'd sit on the kitchen floor with the dog, and my mother, for some reason, put the Purina dog chow on the bottom of the stove in that place where they put pans, you know? And she had the dry food in there, and she had this habit of always cutting off the top of the bag so she could just go in with a scoop. So I would sit there, I'd open the thing, I'd feed my dog some dry food, and then I'd have some. Now this is not normal. I realize this now, that's not normal. But that's what I would do, you know. And so that was my second experience. My next experience was, you know, just my bicycle. My bicycle was like my best friend other than my dog when I was a kid. And living in Washington, D.C., the streets are extremely wide. I mean, we're talking 8 lanes. And I knew where every candy store was by the time I was 6. And I would pedal across town, and I would go there and spend all, you know, a dime, if I had a dime, and I would just pack it and take it home on my bike, and I might hide it in my room. My parents didn't know what I did with my allowance. You know, I get a dime, I think. because candy bars were really big back then, you know, five cents bought you one this big, and then, you know, it was pretty amazing what you could get for a dime. And I did that. So I knew where every candy store was, and it really didn't matter if I was putting myself in jeopardy to do this. I realized this a couple years ago. I said, you really put yourself in physical jeopardy to go by yourself, probably a mile on your bike, crossing all these lanes of traffic just to get candy. That's how desperate I was for sugar at a young age. And then my mother was a great cook. She was a nurse, army nurse, and she made beautiful meals, and we would all, you know, I noticed I was pushing all the food aside, and we'd always wait for the dessert, because you always had dessert. And, you know, the plate never got emptied. I remember many nights sitting at the table, just staring at chicken and going, I don't want to eat it, I don't want to eat it. You know, and I kind of got away with that because Dad was asleep in a chair because he's passed out, and Mom's washing the dishes or bothering with my brother and sister. So I got away with that kind of behavior, and then they relented and gave me the sugar, okay? I know his parents do that a lot to keep kids quiet, you know, and I was the youngest. And so I was probably the most active of the kids. So that was part of the process. Then Mom would bring like sugar into the house. She'd bring stuff and she'd hide it in cupboards. She was hiding my father's alcohol. She was hiding our sugar. I mean, it's like, there's a lot of hiding. And I don't know if she was hiding it from me or from herself, because she had a little bit of a sweet tooth too. But you know, she'd go in these cabinets and there'd be three of us, and you know, all the cookies are gone, and, you know, I don't know which one of us did it. I did a lot, but I know I wasn't the only one. So out of all three of all our family, there's three children, every one of us is a compulsive overeater. I have a 77-year-old brother. He's probably about 400 pounds now. I have a 72-year-old sister. She just joined. She was the first one in OA. She left OA. Joined a biblical group, and also does a Weight Watchers. That's how she keeps her weight off. She's so proud of herself. She ballooned up, and she just lost 40 pounds on Weight Watchers. So that works for her. She said, I'll never go back to an OA meeting again. That's been her path. I never wanted to go to an OA meeting, but here I am, 11 years later. So that was her path, and my path has been, I topped out around 240 pounds. It just sort of happened. Yeah. I would be up and down, and then the 240 hit. I didn't even know I was there, because I'm one of these people, I'm still not very good at this. I don't like to weigh myself very often. Now I kind of go by how my clothes fit. But the 240 happened a year after my mother died, and a year after my stepdaughter graduated high school and went off to college, and I was kind of left there with nobody coming home in the afternoon. I didn't realize that was going to be an issue, that empty nester coming. And I'm not blaming it for that. I'm just saying that was how tragic it got for me. I did not want to go to OA, but I was having trouble. I couldn't get off toilet seats. Some of you who know me know that I did not start OA in this country. I was on a vacation in Mexico, in a town called San Miguel de Allende, a beautiful town, if you've been there. I had a friend, I went with this friend of mine's husband, because I'm gay, they didn't care. I'm safe material for a lot of wives. Anyway, so I went with him, and he was in AA, and he wanted to go to an AA meeting, so I saw there was like this Unity house a few blocks from our apartment. I said, I'll go with you, Bob. I could go. I didn't say anything about Al-Anon, but I'll go. And so it had a big board that had all their meetings. I wish we had one of those in Tucson, but we don't. It had a OA meeting at like another hour after the AA meeting. I said to him afterwards, I said, I think I want to go to this OA meeting. I said, I'm in a foreign country. Nobody will know me. Who I am. I can just sit there, you know. So I go to this meeting, and it's all women. And the woman leading the group looks like me. maybe 10 years old. Probably like me now, anyway. So I kind of identified in with her, you know, and they looked at me and they said, oh, you're a newcomer, because they all kind of knew each other. I said, yes, and they said, well, we don't want you to talk. We don't want you to say a word. We're going to tell you what we want you to hear. I thought, okay, this is a rough crowd. So I sit there and I listen and I just start sobbing. You know, within 5 minutes, I am absolutely just sobbing. And there's just nothing that irritates me more than when somebody hands me a Kleenex when I'm crying. I worked really hard. I never cried before I was 39. I worked really hard to get these tears and I want them all, you know? And so I'm just So, you know, they all hugged me after the meeting, and they said, well, how long are you here? And I said, you know, another three or four days, and then I'll go back to Washington. So you know what I did right after that meeting? I go to the nearest convenience store. I looked for the shiniest, prettiest, most colorful bags of shit. Excuse my French. Most colorful bags of candy, chips, anything. Shove in my mouth. I went back to the apartment, sat on my bed, and just kept piling it in.
Suzanne, could you?
Just kept piling it into my, you know, my mouth. And this went on for three or four days till we came back. And I said, that meeting got to me. It really got to me. And I knew it. I knew I couldn't hide anymore. And I knew that I had to go to a meeting. So I'm like going, okay. Let's look them up, and I knew there was a gay meeting. We have gay meetings in D.C. because it's a large population. Back those days, you know, we were all still hiding out. And we're acceptable now, they tell me. Anyway, so I went to this gay meeting, and lo and behold, there's someone I know from Alma. So immediately, what happens? I identify in. And they said, you know, we do this every week. And I said, great, I'll be there. So I did that for three or four months, just one meeting. And then I found out there was a meeting a block from my house. So I go up to that meeting, and it's like four ladies and me. They're all not like me, but I've already like started to identify in, you know, that really helped. And so I do this, and you know, I just stay at that meeting, and I couldn't, you know, ignore the fact it was a block from my house. I mean, you really, how close does God have to make the meeting for me to go? Unless it's right next door. I mean, really. I mean, I could walk. So I'm there, and I do this thing with them for three or four years, and then we started doing the four step. And I highly recommend doing the four step, not only with a sponsor, but also with the group. So here I am with these four straight ladies and me. And I'm going, what the heck, when we do this four step, could I have in common with these people? And we would share it aloud. Ooh. We'd share it aloud. We'd write, you know, we had the workbook, the old workbook question. We'd do one question and we'd share it aloud. And I'd go, oh my God, just because they're not gay doesn't mean they're not like me around this food thing. Or even in their relationships with other people, the common thread would come up like intimacy. You know, sexual problems, you know, all the things would come up, you know, and it floored me. It was probably the best four step I've ever done because it was just so in the moment, in my face, and so made me show how unique I was not. And this disease that really helped me. So I always recommend that, you know, people do lots of four steps. Now do little four steps, do big four steps. Anyway. Okay, I have to tell one more story before I got recovery. So I had this neighbor, and people who know me in Tucson have heard this. I had this neighbor, really nice guy. It's Girl Scout cookie time. Okay? And he goes, you know what I do? I said, what do you do? He goes, I buy a whole case of Thin Mint cookies. I'm like, really? He goes, yeah, and I put them in the freezer, and then I have them over here. And I go, that is a really good idea. It's my brain. It's going, this is a fantastic idea. Because they're my favorite ones. The other ones, yeah, but the Thin Mint, you know, that's it. order my case, I bring it in the house, I cram as much as I can in the freezer, but there's probably 3 or 4 boxes out. He's planning on his lasting a year, mine's lasting 2 weeks. Max, it may have been even been a week. I was in such a chocolate sugar coma, I don't know, you know. I knew I had a problem then. I also knew I had a problem on my three favorite days, which were the day after Halloween, the day after Christmas, and the day after Easter. Well, that was the day I'd go to CVS, half price candy, pack it up, bring it home, say it's gonna last a long time, and rifle through. I mean, it was just such a series of denial around my eating habits with sugar. And literally, I could have cared less about any other food. I mean, you could put plates of good food, what people would think is good food in front of me, and I would just gorge on the sugar, you know? So I was basically in comas. I think I was in comas, so. That's the way it was. So then my first meeting, I come home and I start my meetings. So I got up to 3 meetings a week. I'm like, good, I'm doing 3 meals a day, nothing in between. This is started in October of 2008. So I do this, things are going great. I got the point cloud, all that stuff, weight's falling off. I'm like, yeah, I'm starting to think in my head, oh, I got this, you know. Have you ever heard that little voice go, I think I got it. I know now, if I ever think that, I ain't got it. I have not got it. In fact, I'm so far away from getting it that I'm just in denial. And so I'm about 3 years in, and I'm like, you know, everybody's talking about their higher power. I'm just not feeling it, you know? So I went to, we have these marathon meetings there in Thanksgiving, and I'm still in D.C., and they would do a step an hour for 12 hours, and you'd sign up. Somebody would sign up to lead, because one meeting was hosted, somebody would sign up to lead, and I came in early in the morning, and like normal, people come the first few hours, and then there becomes the feeding frenzy period, so, and people want to be with their families. So around 3 or 4 o'clock, I had noticed when I was in the morning, there was nobody leading. So I said, well, you know what? I think I'll just go back and be there and see who shows up. So it's around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I forget what step we're on by then, maybe 7 or something. These two people show up, and they're both newcomers. And I said, what if I hadn't been there? It's not about me, but what if somebody from OA hadn't been there that knew the program to help these people start? The fact that they were willing to start on Thanksgiving Day was a miracle in itself, I felt. So I stayed for that, and I stayed for another one. And then I went home and I said, okay, here we go, I'm gonna do my 30 and 30 thing. I came home, I said, you know, I had another meeting the next day, and I had one the next day. I'm like on a 3-day roll here, and I'm going, well, why don't I try this 30 and 30 thing? You know? And so I started gaming it all out, like, okay, this can be a phone meeting, this one's a night meeting, this one's somebody else's, this is a relapse meeting. I had to go to all kinds of meetings because they were so specialized in D.C. because we had so many of them. And I was ending up in places I had no idea how the breadth of this disease, you know. One of the most powerful ones for me was the relapse meeting. I mean, I would walk in and, you know, people who had been in program 20 years were relapsing. And I had to hear the pain of that. And it really impressed me. So I did this 30 and 30, and then, you know, it's like almost around Christmas Eve, and I walk out of this meeting and I go, what are you doing this for? What are you doing this for? And I said, a little voice in my head goes, you're doing it for yourself. It's a gift to you. So that I went, okay, well, let's try 60 and 60. I get there, and then I go, okay, well, other people talk about 90 and 90. I've heard that one. And so I keep going. Day 85, this dude walks up to me. says, Suzanne, I'm so excited you're doing this. I got to tell you, he was in AA first. He goes, when I was in AA, the best year of my life is when I did a meeting a day for a year. And I wanted to punch him. I said, God, why are you bringing me this guy at day 85 to tell me that might make the biggest change in finding you in my whole life? And it did. So I went on. I did a whole year of meetings. I got to tell you, I don't even remember how I pieced it together because I was coming out here. We had a little house out here, and we'd come out a couple times a year, and I'd come to meetings out here. That's how I met some people who were in this room years ago. And I would do it in airports. I would, you know, by that time they had some phone meetings. I could listen to those, you know. And it came about, and it was a miracle. I found my higher power that year. I mean, I felt like I had rock solid found my higher power, and I was so grateful for that. And I will always look back on that year. Since then, I've done a couple of 30 and 30s since I've been here. I moved here in 2012. I felt very grateful that I already was kind of plugged into the program here because I would come out on vacations. And I still, here I am almost a year and a half, 11 and a half years later, I still do two or three meetings a week. I read literature every morning, write to my higher power. I sponsor people. I have a couple of sponsors, actually. I need more than one. I need a lot of help, so, you know, more than one. And it's been great. And one of the weirdest things is I've learned to never know. You know, the reason I go to so many meetings still is that I never know when I'm going to hear the next thing I need to know that I don't know, because I don't know. And it'll come from someone I least expect. You know, they'll say something and I'll go, wow. I remember sitting in a meeting and a woman was saying, you know, I went to sleep every night not knowing if I would wake up or not. I thought, well, what's that about? And she said, well, my father was an alcoholic and he was a smoker. So he would stay up and smoke cigarettes and drink. And I would go to bed not knowing if our house would burn. I had that exact same experience every night in my childhood. And I thought, no one's ever going to have that experience. So everything I've heard, you know, has just made me realize I am not unique. And the origins of my disease, I don't know. You know, I have an alcoholic family. All of us ended up being compulsive overeaters. None of us had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. None of us had to go to NA or any other 12-step program. One of us has stayed, one never got in, one went a whole different direction. I mean, I don't know why we got it. It doesn't really matter. My acceptance of it is being very much part of me and who I am and will always be with me. You know, oh, a year ago, changed my food plan. Dramatic. I went to the doctor, my cholesterol was through the roof. I'm getting older, I'm like 68 now. And he said, you know, you gotta do something about this, we're gonna put you on medication. I said, well, I don't know what to do. I mean, I eat pretty good, you know? So I go to one of my alternative medicine people and they say, you know, you need to change the way you eat. I said, again? I have to change the way I eat again? He said, well, why don't you just try this for 3 months? So I go home and I tell my spouse, 20 some years, the dinners you've been preparing, I can't eat any. And this became what I call the food wars at home, because she's also a compulsive overeater and she does it through a pay and way, okay? So we're counting points, you know, and I'm not allowed to fix dinner because they have to have 0 points or 1 point. I don't know what, you know, I'm just not part of that, but. So I announced that I can't be eating the dinner she's cooking the way she's cooking them. And you would think I had set off a nuclear bomb in my house. She said, this is the straw that's broken the camel's back. And I went, what does that mean? She goes, I just can't take this anymore. And I went, so are you telling me we're going to end our marriage over food? Do you hear yourself? And I said, well, I said, here's the bottom line, I'm going to do it. And I'll cook my own meals if you don't want to cook them. So she wanted to control the meals because of the points, you know, the point thing is really big. So she took every kind of meal, menu, and put it through her number processor and said, oh, well, these I can make. They fit what you need to have done for your food plan. So it's ended up great because she was pre-diabetic. Now she's no longer pre-diabetic. My cholesterol in 3 months went down 40 points. Mm-hmm. Sugars were great. You know, all that stuff worked out, and it's worked out beautifully. But I had to say, I can't do this anymore either. I can't eat like that anymore. I'm killing myself. And it wasn't because of the sugar anymore. It was because of the other stuff. You know, I've always been kind of a 301, small snack in the afternoon kind of person. And what I've also learned is I will always be a compulsive overeater. Doesn't matter what food plan I'm on. I could overeat on green beans. I could fall in love with steamed green beans. I don't know if I'd say that, but I can. So anyway, that's where I am. And I didn't sign up to have my life changed, but gosh, that's what's really changed. You know, the food problem will probably always be there. It's the background, it's the baby comfort, it's the whiny baby in me. That's when I go to my inner child, when I hear that kid going, I want. I know I'm in my little kid, and I need to get my parent on board that says, you know, you may want it, but you can't have it today. Just for today, you can't have it. You string that together enough and you get recovery. What's the other thing I want to say? Oh, I got to tell you about the guy in D.C. sitting in a room and he had to leave. And he said, keep coming back 50 times in his 10-minute speech.
Oh, God.
10 minutes, keep coming back. I think he said, keep coming back. My name is Pete. Keep coming back. And I've never forgotten it, and I've kept coming back. And I urge everybody to just keep coming back. It just takes as long as it takes. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.
All right, we'll open it up for you.
Oh my God, I talked for almost 30 minutes. Oh, hey, I want to give this, you know, that year that I did the meeting a week, I mean a meeting a day and everything,